Hi, I'm Mike Dilk and you're listening to the Relax Back UK show, the show that explores all kinds of health topics relevant to you, your family and your friends. Each week I talk to expert guests from a range of backgrounds to inform and entertain you. So please do join the Relax Back UK family and stay tuned.
Hi and thank you for joining me on the Relax Back UK show. My first guest today is Dr. Vanessa Appiah and she talks about something that's potentially really serious.
You can be symptomless for decades, but if it's left untreated, then the virus can lead to life-threatening conditions like liver cancer or liver failure.
Sounds bad, doesn't it? But actually, it's not all doom and gloom. The topic is hepatitis C, for which there is a simple test and simple treatment. Then more good news, this time from Dr. Claire Bromley of Cancer Research UK.
The good news is that over 1 million lives have been saved from cancer since the 1980s. And I think this stat is just so powerful because it really just shows the incredible difference that medical research can make.
She'll be explaining more about this and the work of CRUK. So please do join me for a great show. Thank you.
This show is cool!
I started my chat with Dr. Appiah about hepatitis C, with me trying to remember what I did when I took my children for vaccinations when they were smaller.
I seem to remember my children are 18 and 13. And I, in the dim distant past, I've got a memory of taking them to the GP to get a vaccination when they were babies. But that was for hepatitis A. Am I likely remembering that correctly?
Yes, hepatitis A or hepatitis B.
Right. So So we've got A, B and C. What's the difference?
Exactly. So we've got all of them are viruses that can affect the liver. But this is we're talking more specifically about hepatitis C, which doesn't have a vaccine for it at the moment. So you wouldn't traditionally take that as a vaccine, but it does have highly effective treatment eradicate the infection.
Okay. All right. Now, the whole thing seems to be that a lot of people might have it or have this virus lurking within them. And they don't even realise it. So, well, two questions, really.
Mm-hmm.
What's a lot? You know, is it really a lot of people? And how could this possibly happen?
Yeah. So, again, really good question. So, first of all, I've just to be clear about hepatitis C. So it's a bloodborne virus, and it means that it can be passed on through traces of blood. And the key thing is that sometimes it can be symptomless for a number of years. So you can be living with the infection and not be experience anything that could suggest that you have it. And in some cases, you can be symptomless for decades. But if it's left untreated, then the virus can lead to life-threatening conditions like liver cancer or liver failure. And it is estimated that there are thousands of people in England who may have unknowingly acquired hepatitis C abroad through tattoos or piercings or, you know, their increasingly popular dental, cosmetic or health procedures.
And yeah, a lot of people are going abroad for plastic surgery, that kind of thing, aren't they?
Exactly. And this can, and so this.
The BBL, what was that? The Brazilian butt lift, that's a current favourite, I think.
No, exactly. And so there are a whole host of procedures. And the thing is that if the equipment for the procedures is not sterilised or there aren't appropriate hygiene measures that are followed, then there is a possibility of hepatitis C being passed on. We're not saying it's for everyone who's gone away or had a tattoo or had a piercing, but it's something to consider. And in terms of the numbers, so we think there are about 70,000 people in the UK that are living with undiagnosed hepatitis C. And there are many different causes of how you can acquire hepatitis C. But when some research has been done, looking at those who have already been treated for hepatitis C and looking back and seeing, you know, how they think they acquired it and looking at that number and then looking at the number of people that are undiagnosed, an estimation has been made that there are thousands that are living with hepatitis C that may have been acquired abroad through tattoos, piercings, or procedures.
I can see how if you get a tattoo abroad, but what kind of one would hope if you're abroad and get a toothache and need a filling and have that horrible anaesthetic that the dentist gives you, which is horrible at the time, but it's probably much less horrible than the pain of going through having a filling without the anaesthetic.
Yeah.
You would hope like dentists, etc., plastic surgeons might sterilize their tools a bit more.
You would. And that is that should be the standard protocol. But we do know that that may not be consistent. And so, again, as I said, it's not to deter anyone from traveling, from procedures, etc. It's just being number one. Actually, I think it's really important when people do have procedures in of any form to be, you know, inquire about sterilization, etc. But if someone has already had this, for their peace of mind, we're encouraging people to test for hepatitis C. It's really quick and easy. You can get a test to be sent to your home, do it at home, you know, it confidentially, and then send it back for testing and to get your result.
I've got lots of questions to ask you about the testing and what have you. But before we get on to that, just supposing, say, 20 years ago, in your youth, you got a tattoo when you're on holiday.
Mm-hmm.
And this virus is in your blood.
Mm-hmm.
What can make it suddenly switch on or do its, you know, do its business and cause you liver problems? Because you might have been perfectly fine for 20 years.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think, again, really good question. So there are some people that can acquire an infection, hepatitis C, and actually the body may clear it. And there are some people that will go on to keep hold of the virus and it stays and it becomes chronic, so longer lasting, and then it can act on the body and cause things such as liver failure or liver cancer. And you know, as always, there's research that's happening to explore, you know, the specific triggers and what and why some people do and some people don't. And there's testing to understand, you know, the type of hepatitis C someone has and whether that's relevant. But the key thing is that you will not know which one you've fallen into, and you can't predict that. So the key thing to kind of break the chain of this is testing and getting diagnosed.
Sure. And say it's been in with you've had it for 5 years, or you've had it for 10 years or 20 years. When you do get, if you do get the liver problem, will it be worse if it's been lurking for 20 years or been lurking for 5 years? Does it sort of slowly build up within you and then make itself known?
Potentially, yes. So, and the reason I just say potentially, because it's just the way that we think about it. So we, in terms of having liver failure and the liver not working as well, how long that lasts can vary from individual to individual, and also progressing on to potentially liver cancer. So the longer that someone has chronic hepatitis C, the more likely that there's a possibility that they may move to liver cancer. So yes, in all of that, the earlier that you diagnose and start treatment, the better.
Okay. All right. So there is a test. Let's get onto the test.
Yeah.
So, well, first of all, why should you get the test? Are there potential symptoms to look out for? And you might think, oh, hang on a moment, I need to get the test done. Or has anyone who's been abroad and, say, had one of these things like a tattoo or been to the dentist, should they go and get it?
So I think there are two groups of people. So as I've said, that there are many people that may not have any notable symptoms until the liver has been significantly damaged. And so in those cases, we say that if what we're describing the tattoos, the piercings, interventions abroad. If that's relevant to you, we're just encouraging people to just think, okay, if you haven't had a test for hepatitis C for any other reason, we're encouraging people to go and have a test and access that. But also, when symptoms do occur, they can often be mistaken for other conditions. And symptoms can include flu-like symptoms, so, you know, muscle ache, high temperature, I'm sure many people have, you know, had last week, you know, and it isn't hepatitis C, but it can.
Oh, actually, my wife's just had that because of COVID.
Exactly. So, you know, there's many things that it could be. So it may not even be on someone's mind to test for it. Feeling tired all the time, loss of appetite, a stomach ache, feeling or being sick. So the only way for certain to know if these are caused by hepatitis C is to get tested.
All right. The next question is, how do you get tested?
Great. So NHS England have been running a fantastic hepatitis C elimination program, which has diagnosed already so many people with hepatitis C, and exploring people from that, raising awareness about it, should I say, and thinking of people that may have injected drugs in the past or actively injecting drugs. So other cohorts of people that have lived in certain parts of the world, so a lot of awareness has been raised for those groups of people. And we are raising awareness for those in these groups in terms of the procedures and tattoos and piercings, etc. And there is a free confidential home test that is now available, that is provided. And you can go into the website, www.hepctest.nhs.uk, www.hepctest.nhs.uk. And you can go on there, you put in your details. The test kit will be sent to your home. It's in a really generic packaging. So, you know, not suspicious for any reason. You do the testing at home in the privacy of your own home or space, and then you put it back in the post, send it for testing, and then you can receive your results by text. So it's a really simple way of testing and kind of giving yourself peace of mind.
Right. So, but it needs some of your blood.
Indeed it does. So right.
How do you get that out of you into the test?
Yes. So just to talk about that. So the home testing kit involves, so it's a finger prick. And so there's a little needle, and it's a small blood sample, which then has to be dropped into a test tube. So finger prick, small blood sample into a tube, and then that is tested back to the lab for analysis. And then you will be, if someone does receive a positive test result, they'll be contacted and then linked into treatment.
All right. So, all right, let's suppose you've gone through this, you've done the test, and it comes back positive. Yeah, you said, right, get on with the treatment. What does the treatment consist of?
Great. So once someone has been told that the test is reactive, they'll be linked into care, and then they will see a hepatologist, as someone that specializes in caring for people with liver disease, for the most appropriate treatment. And there is a course of medication that people will take over a number of weeks, the current medication can cure hepatitis C effectively. And really, we've come so far with Hep C treatment. And so it really has limited or no side effects. So it's treatment for a couple of weeks. And we are working generally to curing the hepatitis C and getting rid of it completely.
All right. So it's an antiviral medication that you take for a couple of weeks, and there doesn't appear to be much in the way of side effects.
Yes. And so we call them, just for people to know, they're kind of directly acting antiviral tablets. And these are the safest, the most effective medicines for treating hepatitis C.
Right. And so then after a couple of weeks, do you take the test again?
Yes.
To see if it's negative.
Yeah, so you're monitored through that in terms of assessing your liver function and assessing your response. And then the tablets may be taken for 8 to 12 weeks and then were tested after to see whether you have cleared the infection.
All right. So I've got to say, this seems very simple. It almost seems like a no-brainer to do the test. Have I missed something?
No, you haven't. I think I like your description. I think that the key thing here is that it's about raising awareness because people may not know that they're eligible or should consider testing. Once, and it's like many things, we've got the resources and we've got the opportunities for people to test. In this specific case, you can test at home. You just go on to a website and order this test. And so it is really simple. But the key thing is people have to know that they need to consider it. And that's the big piece of work that all organizations are doing to raise awareness.
Right. So that's what the NHS has to do. And presumably, actually looking at it from a sort of a purely business viewpoint, this is very sensible for the NHS because providing a test and then providing 2 weeks of a course of treatment has got to be much cheaper than treating people for you know, really horrible liver disease.
Completely. And it's like many things, earlier intervention saves lives, improves quality of lives, and also is the most cost-effective way of managing disease. And but as ever, as I've said, it's that whole element of being able to find the right people. And so, for example, in this testing campaign, it's a partnership between NHS England and Preventex. And so Preventex is the laboratory company, and they work in partnership with NHS England to offer this new testing service. And online testing is really to complement, you know, all the vital in-person testing that happens across the UK. And it's really important that we find the right people, give them as many opportunities to test, and then identify new cases of undiagnosed hepatitis C so we can work towards eliminating it.
Sure. All that is very good news. Let me ask a question which is probably wholly unfair, but I'll ask it anyway. I don't suppose you have any data on sort of the difference in costs between doing some of these tests and treating with a short course of tablets against, you know, treating with someone who's got, you know, a really nasty liver disease.
So it's not a nasty question at all, actually. I think it's, again, another really good question. I don't have, I feel like I would be giving you numbers that probably won't do it justice. And my health economics colleagues would slap me down if I gave really unrealistic numbers. But I think what is fair to say and what you've alluded to and expanded on is that I do think it is very, very clear that the earlier that you test and treat, the more cost effective it is, because that person has less comorbidities, other things to manage, and all those other conditions to manage require investment and financing in healthcare. So if you can avoid all of those complications, it is inherently more cost effective. And it's very similar to I work in HIV, so another bloodborne virus, and our work is focused on earlier diagnosis and treatment. Not only does that improve the outcomes for individuals, but it also is more cost effective. So I think the earlier the better for most things.
Good. And if these individuals can continue to work, you know, they can make a contribution, they can pay taxes, you know, so it's a win-win-win, really.
Well, it is because the key thing is it's all about living and quality of life and everyone being able to function, contribute and enjoy society. By intervening early, that's when you can make a difference. But more advanced disease you know, it is inherently more complex to manage.
Yeah, no, I get it. And earlier you mentioned something which I just want to ask you about. You said Prevent X. So that's a company. How do they fit into it?
So Prevent X, which is the company that I'm one of the medical directors of, is one of the largest providers of remote sexual health testing in the UK. And so, and they have partnered with NHS England to bring remote hepatitis C testing to the UK, which is fantastic. And so it is a company that provides laboratory diagnostics, but also supports the dispatch of the tests to individuals, works to develop the online platform that people are recording and accessing the testing. So from the online portal to dispatching the test to the laboratory diagnosis, that is the role of PreventX. And they are working in conjunction with NHS England, as they do with a number of NHS trusts for the sexual health testing, to provide remote testing so people can do it in the comfort of their homes.
So do they develop these tests as well, or just sort of send them out and deal with them?
Oh, so they perform the test. So they perform the analysis. So they have the infrastructure and the machines to test the blood to check whether there is antibodies to hepatitis C.
They're not in the business of doing the research to invent the tests in the first place.
No. But what I will say is that being a part of this and working to, you know, to change public health outcomes, the work and the insight and the data, that is all research, and that is all part of really shaping what is the right care for people. So in that way, they are definitely part of the research. But no, they didn't develop the specific test, as it were.
So PreventX is a company that a lot of this stuff is sort of, if you like, subbed out by the NHS for them to take care of all this.
So yes, but just to be really mindful of it, just to highlight, because I think it's a really good point, is that the key thing here is about taking a small drop of blood and being able to test that sample effectively to check for hepatitis C. And that laboratory infrastructure is what PreventX provides.
No, very good. All right. No, you've made that very clear. Thank you. Don't worry, I'm not in a position, because frankly, I don't really know enough about it, to go into a discussion about how NHS works and all this.
Oh, no. I think it's really good, though, to discuss it and think about how different organisations collaborate in public health. That's good. What I love.
Well, you've really answered all my questions perfectly. And this is something which I hadn't heard of, really, knew nothing about. And I'm quite sure many of the listeners will be in the same situation. So perhaps just to finish, I could ask you to give the website again that gives more information about this. If people are worried or think, goodness, you know, I did have a toothache and went to go and see the dentist 10 years ago in some foreign land. Perhaps I need to find out a bit more about this or take the test. What's the website that they can go to with all the information and instructions on what to do?
Great. So you can order a free, confidential, simple home testing kit and get more information by visiting www.hepctest.nhs.uk. So that's www.hepctest.nhs.uk.
Excellent. Right. So, Dr. Appiah, thank you very much indeed for chatting. I think that is probably very helpful for a lot of people.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Dr. Claire Bromley is a Senior Information Manager at Cancer Research UK, otherwise known as CRUK. And so my first question to her was, what does an information manager at CRUK do?
Of course, that's a great question, isn't it? So what we do, like my team, we're involved in really like talking about all the incredible research that Cancer Research UK is doing. So we really have an understanding of, you know, what exciting advances have happened in cancer research to date, and what is the really cool research that Cancer Research UK is funding right now. And we, you know, produce content about that.
All right, excellent. Well, so then the topic is the great strives that have been made since the 1980s about, you know, how many people actually survive cancer and all that kind of thing. So it sounds like I'm talking to exactly the right person.
No, fantastic. I'm really excited to chat to you about this.
Good. So you've come up with some news about mortality rates in cancer since the 1980s, and it's some good news. So what is the good news?
The good news is that over 1 million lives have been saved from cancer since the 1980s. And I think this stat is just so powerful because it really just shows the incredible difference that medical research can make.
Okay. And that's, success has been more in some cancers than other cancers. Is that right?
Yeah, you've got that spot on. So while we've seen over the past 50 years, cancer survival has doubled, unfortunately, this hasn't been the case across all cancers. And there are six types of cancers in our research strategy that are particularly hard to treat. So these include things like brain tumours and pancreatic cancer.
Okay, all right. But the ones that have become, I was going to say easy to treat, that's probably not the right phrase, is it? But tend to have more success now. I would imagine breast cancer might be one of them.
Yeah, breast cancer, we've seen a huge difference, and also lung cancer as well in some ways. For breast cancer, there's been a couple of key shifts since the early 1980s. The first is the introduction of a national screening program, which happened in 1988. Then also we've had really exciting drug developments, which are targeting like specific changes that happen in breast cancer, such as, you know, Herceptin and tamoxifen, which Cancer Research UK scientists were involved in.
Okay. All right. And the other ones that have seen success, there's stomach cancer. Is that right?
Yeah. So actually what we've seen is that the number of people with stomach cancer and also the number of deaths from stomach cancer have fallen substantially in recent decades. And that's largely because a bacteria that causes infection known as H. pylori, you know, is no longer common. So one of those risk factors of disease has been reduced.
Okay. And has that been reduced through luck, or, you know, how come that risk factor has gone down?
So we know, that for H. pylori or Helicobacter pylori, that's a bacterium that causes things like stomach ulcers. And actually it's been research that showed that, you know, it was that bacteria that was causing these stomach ulcers. And then that led to things like antibiotics being able to be used to treat that.
Right. Okay. All right. Now I got it. I've got a question for you, which I don't know if it's unfair. I think it might be a bit of a nasty question, but I'll ask it anyway. So the rates of death and the rates of people being cured of cancer have gone up quite a lot, certainly for some cancers. But what about the actual numbers? Because my impression, and this is just based on my impression, this isn't based on any research, is that more and more people are diagnosed with cancer than ever before. So are the actual numbers going up or down as opposed to the rates?
Yeah, so what we've seen, because of population growth and also an aging population, so obviously aging is a key kind of risk factor, as it were, for cancer, and the absolute numbers of deaths have continued to rise. However, that kind of rates of survival have really improved since the 1980s because of advances in prevention, diagnostics and treatment.
Sure. Okay. Now, so we covered a little bit about what some of the success is attributable to, you know, why the success is happening. And and one of the things you said is, you know, just because of the advances in the research that is going on here. Now, I must admit, I feel quite personally involved in this because my wife is a cancer researcher, and so I kind of live it vicariously. But I'm keen to know if the future is continuing to look rosy.
Yeah, I think so. What we're seeing to get to this kind of over 1 million lives saved from cancer, what we've seen is like incremental breakthroughs in cancer research. And I think as we continue to do discovery research, so that's research looking into, you know, understanding what causes cancer, how does it develop, how does cancer evade treatments? As we build our understanding in this area, we're only going to see new preventions, diagnostics and treatments coming through the pipeline. And at Cancer Research UK, we support the whole of that cancer research pipeline, right from that initial drug discovery research all the way into how you get those discoveries from the lab into the clinic.
Okay. In the press release that came out, I did a little bit of homework before our chat. And it says that CRUK says strong political leadership is needed to keep, you know, this good work and these good results going in the area of research and also in the NHS, because, you know, they're both under quite a lot of strain at the moment. So this strong political leadership, what do you want to see from that as far as the research side of things is concerned?
So I think on the research side of things, it's absolutely essential that things like Horizon Europe are sorted so that, you know, researchers across the UK can collaborate or work together with researchers across Europe and get the funding that they need for cancer research. And there also needs to be more investment from the government in that cancer research, because what we need to maintain is the UK is being like this, you know, hotspot of like really great cancer research. But we really risk seeing a brain drain if, you know, there isn't the support for cancer researchers that's needed.
So have you actually already seen, you know, a lack of people wanting to come to the UK to do their PhD and do their postdocs? And, you know, as they get more senior, good scientists, you know, going elsewhere?
Yeah, and I think like anecdotally, it's some of the kind of stories that we're hearing from our researchers that you are starting to see that kind of it's getting harder to get talented young scientists to consider the UK and to do their cancer research. But I don't think, you know, we just need to act quickly to make sure things like Horizon Europe can then, you know, work again so that we have that kind of collaboration and strong research kind of continuing in the UK.
Yeah, are things looking rosy for that? What's the latest? I've lost track a little bit on the Horizon thing.
So we're hoping to hear more on the autumn, and we're really calling on the government and lobbying them to make sure that they really see this as a priority.
Okay. All right. Well, good luck with that. And at the end, I'm going to ask you what everyone else can do. So if there's anything there that members of the public can do to help, we'll get an answer from you later. What about within the NHS? You know, the strong political leadership that you're after to keep things moving in the right direction within the NHS. What's required there?
Yeah, I think there's a couple of like really key things to consider. The first thing is that it's really important to think about, you know, if we diagnose cancer earlier, treatment is more likely to be effective. So at Cancer Research UK, we've been campaigning for years to reduce cancer wait times, but, you know, cancer wait targets are being missed every month. And this is just completely unacceptable when actually a matter of weeks can, you know, be long enough for the cancer to progress. And what we've seen recently is then, you know, the changes to waiting time targets in England. So that's meant, you know, that faster diagnosis standard being introduced. And instead of having 9 cancer wait time targets, we now have 3. You know, and this hopefully will give clearer expectations for patients. But it really doesn't address is those kind of systemic challenges. So we need that strong leadership to make sure that, you know, everyone has access to that cancer treatment and care. And if I may, I'll just quickly talk about the geographic variations as well, because I think that's maybe another important factor as well. Because I think, you know, across the UK, you have patients waiting much longer for a diagnosis, depending on where they're based. And this, again, is just unacceptable because, you know, everyone, wherever they live, should have access to, you know, that timely diagnosis and also high quality treatment.
So, I mean, I know you're a scientist and we're talking about scientific things here, but anecdotally, I've got some evidence and it's good evidence. a good friend of mine was recently diagnosed with breast cancer. It happened pretty quickly, and then the treatment started to happen pretty quickly as well after that. So, you know, it's things do seem to be working currently, generally speaking, although I'm sure you can come across some stories where things haven't gone quite as well as they should have done. But we're looking to the future here, really, aren't we? We want to keep things going well and efficiently.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why it's important that the government has that 10-year plan of how they'll tackle cancer.
Okay. Now, we've spoken a bit about the strong political leadership that CRUK wants to do. And you said you're lobbying government to try and make this happen, both for research and for within the NHS. So that sounds like a very good start to me. I didn't realise CRUK was kind of a lobbying sort of organisation as well. But what about the rest of us? What about Joe Public? What can we do to help the situation? I'm thinking things like potentially if there's an opportunity or you get invited to go to a cancer screening, just go. take advantage of the invitation, because actually it could save your life. Things like that. What can the rest of us do?
Yeah, I definitely think with cancer screening, it's important that everyone makes that informed decision about whether or not to take up screening. So there are three different screening programs available at the moment, and they're breast screening, cervical cancer screening, and bowel cancer screening. So, you know, there are risks and benefits associated with all of these screening programs, but we really urge everyone to like make a considered decision about whether to participate. Because, you know, these screening programs really help detect cancer earlier, which, as I've said previously, is what, you know, helps make treatments more effective. I'd also say that, you know, people should understand, you know, what's normal for them. So don't wait to get a screening invitation if you're noticing something unusual. Please do, you know, go and talk to your GP if you have any concerns.
Okay. Again, I can add some anecdotal information for you. A few months ago, I got a package through the post and it was a test to check for bowel cancer. I think it was, so I'm 57. I think it was an age thing. This thing appeared. It was dead easy to do. I did the test. I put a bit of poo in the kind of little container, sent it off to the laboratory. I felt a bit sorry for the poor person that was opening all these letters. But anyway, shortly I got the letter back saying, everything's fine, carry on. So, you know, and it was dead easy to do. So my thought was, well, why wouldn't you?
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's a lot of stigma around almost like this poo in the post test. But as you said, it is actually really simple and it's been kind of made easier by how the sampling is like collected now. So definitely do consider taking up that bowel screening.
Okay, so that's what the public can do. Well, actually, there's one other thing, a couple of other things which I'll touch on. Should we be getting the public to write to our MPs? You said that, you know, we need strong political leadership. Can we get involved?
Yeah, exactly. So at Cancer Research UK, we actually have people who volunteer to be part of our campaigners and lobbying the government. So I'd suggest that anyone's interested in finding out more, if you head over to our website, cruk.org, you can find out more about how you can get involved in that campaigning element of our organisation.
Really? Okay, that sounds interesting. Very good. I like that one. Then, of course, if anyone feels they've got some spare cash, you are a charity. You do collect money. People can donate to the cause.
Yes, definitely. So we've actually today released our new fundraising campaign, which is called Together We Are Beating Cancer. And what this really means is that, you know, through research, we're getting more moments with the people we love. And there's so many different ways that people can support Cancer Research UK. All the progress that has been made to date in cancer research is only possible thanks to our incredible supporters. And people could, you know, consider pledging to leave a gift in their will, donating to the charity, fundraising for us, or even volunteering or taking part in campaigning.
Okay, what sort of roles are there when it comes to volunteering that people might be able to do?
So there's loads of different things. Obviously, people could get involved in the CIEK shops or Cancer Research UK shops. They could also be involved in our events such as Race for Life. But what I would do is just encourage anyone who is interested in volunteering for Cancer Research UK to again go to our website, because all the different volunteering opportunities are on there and you might find one that works well for you. There's also a lot of patient involvement as well, which I should touch on too, is in people who have experience of cancer can, you know, be involved in kind of setting some of the direction of research or perhaps even sharing their story if they'd like to become a media volunteer.
Okay, all right. That sounds like some excellent things that people can do. I've got one final question, maybe. Maybe it's final, unless I think of any more. Would you recommend any budding scientists in the UK to go ahead and start their career in cancer research? And if so, in cancer research in the UK?
Yes, of course I would, but you have to say I'm a little biased. But I do think that there's a really great environment for cancer researchers in the UK. It's incredibly collaborative, but I think we also need to think beyond the UK, right? So researchers in the UK have lots of like global collaborations, and it's only by researchers working together to address these huge challenges that we have in cancer research that we're going to get to that future where everyone lives longer, better lives, free from the fear of cancer.
Excellent. Well, that sounds like an excellent place to leave it. So please just give us the website if people want to find out more, some of those opportunities you mentioned earlier to volunteer or help with lobbying or whatever it might be.
Of course. So people can find out more by heading to cruk.org.
Excellent. All right, Claire, look, thank you very much indeed for chatting.
Thanks so much. That was a really interesting discussion.
Thank you very much to my guests on this week's show, and they were Dr. Vanessa Appiah talking about hepatitis C and Dr. Claire Bromley from the CRUK talking about the progress in treatment for cancers in the last few years. A big thank you to you for listening. I really do appreciate all listeners, and if you're listening to the podcast version, please remember to like and tick the box where it will pop up again for you next week, all that kind of thing. And please do have a healthy week until next week.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Thanks for listening to the Relax Back UK show. Join me, Mike Dilk, again next week for more fascinating interviews and chat. If you're listening to the podcast version, please subscribe, like, and share it with your family and friends. And have a healthy week. Until next week.